Hi, and welcome back to the Spartan History Podcast. This is episode 3, The Face That Launched 1,000 Ships, part 3, Helen's Knossos. Knossos, homecoming. It's been a journey worthy of epic proportions for Helen, and fittingly, it has been told in an epic cycle of works. We've been with her from a mystical and violent genesis on the banks of the Eurotas River, whereby Zeus set his grand scheme in motion. Helen's mother Leda was the vessel for that god's foul ambitions to set hero against hero and man against man in a generation of bloodshed. As she grew to womanhood, the first intimations of a life spent as the target for others' whims came to light as an aged Theseus claimed Helen as his own by force. Escaping that fate with the help of her brothers, she returned home only to become a wedding prize contested for by the heroes of Greece. With the oath of Tyndareus sworn, and Menelaus winning her hand, it seemed the Spartan princess could relax. A daughter, and a few years of peace with her family, perhaps lulled her into a sense of security. A golden apple and the promise that came with would see a Trojan prince descend upon Sparta to shatter that happy home. An Aphrodite-adorned Paris whisked Helen away to the other side of the Aegean Sea. Here she would languish as a bystander for a decade whilst Greek and Trojan hacked away at each other in her name. We saw the veil slowly slip from her eyes as the realization of Paris's perfidy dawned on her pale face. Beginning to long for home, her silent lamentation increased. Watching her chief ally and a far better man, Hector, collapse on the field to mighty Achilles, Helen closed out the Iliad with his funeral oration. As Hector's ashes scattered randomly on the breeze, so too was Helen's potential fate pulled in different directions. In the last line of the oration, a knowing of true isolation settled on Helen, and she lived in a city full of those who despised her. On the other side of the walls, her countrymen may well have had similar sentiments. Having been the focal point for so much death and privation, the cold hand of fate weighed heavily upon her. We will take her story through to its natural conclusion, the fall of Troy and her eventual Knossos. As Helen's fate since birth was intertwined with that of the Trojans, we'll look at how the holy city fell after a decade-long war. Helen, we'll see, played no small part in the closing stages of the drama, being also one of the central figures of the entire war. Her centrality to the plotline is not something I've constructed. Indeed, she has been the fulcrum point of Zeus's will all along. After the Iliad, our next chief account for Helen is the Odyssey. Its story picks up 10 years after Troy's fall and focuses primarily on Odysseus. A collection of tales told by the narrative's protagonists, it often casts back retrospectively on the past 10 years since Troy's fall. Within its hallowed covers, Homer gives us a few tantalizing moments of apparent harmony between Helen and Menelaus back in Sparta. He also gives us some useful information for their return journey after the war. Details are scarce, but we can call upon the Chrestomathy to help build the story from Hector's funeral. Virgil's Aeneid gives key insight into the inter-Homer years, as that poet leant heavily on the lost epics epitomised in the Chrestomathy. The next event of note to occur during the war, and for Helen, would be the prophesied death of Achilles. This happened as the Trojans were joined by an allied contingent of Amazons. They combined forces to slowly beat the Achaeans back from the city. The Amazon queen, Penthesilea, hacks her way through the Greek troops at the head of her forces. Unfortunately, her moment in the sun is quite literally cut short by Achilles and his bronze sword. With this death, the Trojans and the warrior women lose heart and begin to flee back into the city via the Scaean Gate. The son of Peleus leads his men in a counterattack and pursuit and very nearly storms the gate in the process. There is, however, one Trojan who doesn't have his back turned in flight. From his position above the Scaean Gate, Paris bends back his bow and looses an arrow at the rampant Achaeans. This dart, imbued by the god Apollo, is true in its progression and silent in its flight. Lodging within the person of Achilles, it brings down the greatest hero of the age. One story says that Paris had poisoned the arrow, in accordance with his nature. This is credible. Though the more popular story suggests that the son of Peleus had a weak spot and Achilles' heel. Either way, Paris added further insult to his reputation by bringing down a champion with the weapon of cowards, and not, as dictated by custom, in single combat. Whilst a low act, it did forward the Trojans a reprieve from battle as the Greeks gave up their chase to take the body of their hero back to camp for burial. Carried off by his adoring citizens, Paris went to enjoy his newfound fame. Like a silent sentinel upon the Scaean gate, Helen stared after the corpse of Achilles. I haven't mentioned it before, due to my story going a different way, but Helen and Achilles had met during the war. The meeting occurred some years after the Greeks landed in Troy. After beating the Trojans back from the beach and within their city, they send an embassy to discuss the repatriation of Helen and the stolen treasure. Rebuffed in their mission, the Achaean forces settle into a pattern of siege. To alleviate the boredom siege brings, they busied themselves by attacking and destroying neighbouring allied cities. During a lull, Proclus mentions in his Summer of the Kypria that Achilles longs to see Helen. It might be that after coming so far and witnessing so much destruction, he wanted to gauge for himself the reason for the conflict. No source suggests that Achilles and Helen had met prior to the war. In fact, Hesiod, in his catalogue of women, indicates Achilles was too young to compete for her hand at the swearing of the Tyndarean oath. Not bound, as others were, he had no reason apart from glory to be at Troy. Proclus goes on to tell us that his mother, Thetis, and the goddess Aphrodite contrived to insert him into the city to meet with Helen. Thetis was an immortal, and had the gift of foresight. She knew it was her son's destiny to die with great glory on the fields of Troy. Wanting her son to meet the fabled beauty makes sense, given man's propensity for abducting poor Helen. If Achilles repeated history and fled with her, perhaps his untimely death could be avoided. You can't blame a mother for trying. Aphrodite's motives are harder to discern, seeing as she had gone to great lengths to bring Paris and Helen together. As much as a god could love a mortal, this goddess had affections for Paris. What could she gain by bringing Achilles within Troy? Who knows what took place when he met Helen? Your guess is as good as mine, but the next thing that is written by Proclus indicates the Greeks grew wary of the protracted siege and decided to sail home. It would be Achilles, who, as mentioned, was not oath-bound, who checked them in their desire to return and leads them on to battle. Seemingly whatever happened with Helen, it steeled his mind into staying at Troy and seeking his glory on the field. The sequence of events is rife with innuendo and inference, and I curse Proclus for not giving us just a little more information to flesh out the motives of Greece's greatest hero. My mind boggles at the possibilities wrapped up in the conversation. An enigma, wrapped in a conundrum? The only thing for sure would be Helen's lack of joy at Achilles' fall. Let's get back to the story proper, with Paris celebrating his triumph and the Greeks burying their champion. The exasperated Achaeans are at a loss as to what to do next. Deteriorating in a siege for a decade, Achilles has been brought low by the unmanly tactics of the one who spat upon hospitality. Brute force had been tried and failed numerous times, which left the attackers with only one other, not so obvious, means for victory. Fortunately for the Greeks, Odysseus and his cunning mind were on their side, and the complicated man ambushed and captured a Trojan seer by the name of Helenus. The wily old king Priam had 50 sons and 50 daughters, so we are told by Homer. Helenus was another of his sons. Taught the gift of foresight by his sister Cassandra, whom obviously did a fantastic job because unlike herself, Helenus seems to have been believed in his predictions. Brother and sister had both predicted the ruin of Troy years before at the birth of Paris. It stood to reason that they also knew how that ruin would be brought about. Falling into the hands of Odysseus, Helenus spilt the proverbial beans. Helen, ignorant to the goings-on outside the walls, would have no idea that the seeds of Troy's destruction were being sown. The next significant event in her life is something I've been looking forward to describing, and that would be the death of Paris. Unfortunately, the sum of his misdeeds didn't weigh him down to Tartarus. Moreover, it seems after the death of Achilles, his star was on the rise. That was, of course, until he was challenged to single combat once more, a challenge he accepted. His opponent was new on the scene, having recently arrived from the island of Lemnos, some 70 kilometres away. The three great tragedians, Euripides, Aeschylus, and Sophocles, all wrote plays about a Greek hero named Philoctetes. He had a fairly colourful life, to put it lightly, but had experienced a cruel twist of fate. The premier archer of Greece, we met Philoctetes in the first part of this series as a participant in the Oath of Tyndareus. Being a swearer of said oath, he was obligated to participate in the war to return Helen to her rightful husband. He departed with the Achaeans from Aulis after the sacrifice of Iphigenia. His journey would cease on the island of Lemnos, where the fleet made one of its many stops on the way to Troy. Here Philoctetes would receive a nasty snake bite which began to fester and smell poorly. This rancid scent was something that quite possibly would outlast religion, and Odysseus convinced the Greeks to leave the wounded man behind, along with his stench. That's where he'd been this past decade, living a lamentable existence marooned on Lemnos with nothing but a smelly wound to keep him company. Odysseus's captured seer Helenus had spoke of the Achaeans' need of Philoctetes and his magic bow to take Troy. Off Odysseus sailed with Achilles' son, Neoptolemus, and the pair tricked a justifiably grumpy Philoctetes into coming to Troy. In the Greek camp, a son of the god Asclepius healed the decade-old wound once and for all. Restored of health, and to his countrymen, Philoctetes immediately challenged Paris to single combat. Both opponents employed the bow and arrow as their weapon of choice. As in the last episode, when Paris and Menelaus fought before the Scaean Gate, it would be safe to assume that Helen watched this combat as well, mounting the steps to the battlements, sitting once more with King Priam. On the plain before them, the two archers squared off. Paris was the first to loose his dart, which flew true but missed a swerving Philoctetes, to bury itself in the chest of a nearby Achaean named Cleodorus. Philoctetes then returned fire, and his first salvo went through to graze the wrist of Paris, causing him to stumble in pain and drop his bow. This gave the Greek time to fire another shot, with this one lodging itself deep in the Trojan's groin. Loud was his cry as agony gripped his soul. As the defiler of hospitality sucked in his breath to scream further, a third arrow transfixed his right eye, followed by a fourth in the foot. His soul was already in Hades as he collapsed to the ground, his armour ringing about him. According to the Chrestomathy, Menelaus ran forward and began to mutilate the corpse, taking what vengeance he could on the body of the man who had caused him so much grief. The plain commenced once more, and although regaining the corpse of Paris, the Trojans are beaten back within their city, never to sally forth again. A pall of shocked silence settled over those watching from the Scaean Gate. The king, who loved his sons dearly, surely shuddered in grief as another of his children collapsed in death on the field. To Helen, a woman with a deep sense of justice, it would seem a fitting end to a man whose honour was non-existent. Though I doubt she experienced any joy as her intelligence dictated the next phase of her story was at hand. The three goddesses from the judgment of Paris watched on keenly as well. Athena and Hera both nodded in satisfaction as the one who denied them the apple perished. Unable to protect her favourite this time, Aphrodite shed a tear. As I never particularly liked Paris, you could say that I'm in the camp of Athena and Hera. Paris's one-way ticket to the underworld in no way offered a reprieve from marital disharmony for our Helen. Barely had the funeral pyre of her dead husband gone cool when she was promptly married off to another of Priam's sons, the prince Deiphobus. This man had served the city of Troy admirably, if somewhat in the shadow of his brother Hector, over the past decade. There is an inference, in the sources, that he was awarded Helen as some form of trophy for his exploits against the Achaeans. We get little to no detail about this wedding other than the fact it occurred. For Helen, you can forgive her for wishing it was all over. The man she had left her home, husband, and daughter for was naught but ash floating on the Aegean Sea's breeze. Menelaus was outside the holy walls of Troy with the rest of the Greeks, still hell-bent on her retrieval. The constant worry as to her fate would drive even the strongest of minds to vexation. Her wish for resolution, one way or the other, was a constant companion and the desire for closure likely overwhelming. In my mind, Deiphobus was a more worthy man for Helen's hand than Paris by far. Although, I would suggest that he was still far removed from what the daughter of Leda wanted most. Home. Her wish was imminently close to being granted. One night, walking the darkened streets of Troy to get some fresh air and escape her new husband, Helen came across a beggar. At first nothing seemed amiss. However, on closer inspection this pauper did not have the bearing of one raised in poverty. Covered in wounds, bruises, and dressed in rags, Odysseus had entered the city with such cunning, none but Helen recognized him. She immediately took the complicated man in, washed, and anointed him. Within Troy was a sacred artifact known as the Palladium, a carved sculpture sacred to the goddess Athena. Odysseus told Helen that he needed to steal away with this object to symbolically free Athena from the city and allow her to help the Achaeans with their victory. This meeting is heavily understated in the sources, but I'd like to dwell on it for a moment. The complicated man had just told Helen that without this object the Greeks were at a loss on how to bring down the city and the Trojans. She had in her control the ability to save Troy, or put steps in place to assure its downfall and all that meant. After 10 years of frustration, the attackers were hardly disposed to a civilized storming of the city. Helen knew this would mean the enslavement of all the women and the murder of everyone else, children included. The decision no doubt weighed heavily. Of Paris, or even Hector, Helen would have felt as if the sword of Damocles hung above her and the longing for home a strain she could barely withstand. I believe it is in consideration of all this that Helen agreed to assist Odysseus in his quest for the Palladium of Athena. She conspired to insert another Greek hero within the city, Diomedes, and led them both via a secret tunnel onto the Acropolis of Troy, where the statue was located. As she walked home, wrapped in a white shawl, the clashing of swords and the cry of the city watch echoed throughout the streets as the two Argive heroes made their way out of Troy with the statue. In the morning, as she made her way out onto the streets, the city was abuzz with news. Grabbing at a passerby, Helen inquired as to the commotion and was informed of the night's events. "Two Achaeans, princess, broke into the tower last night and carried off the carven image of Athena. They were mighty, and left a trail of dead in their wake as they made their way from the city." That was the story she heard. The prophecy of the captured seer Helenus completed. What form would Troy's annihilation take? Okay, no more horsing around. The Olympian gods enjoyed toying with the lives of mortals, but one thing they took very seriously was their own self-preservation. Now symbolically out of the city completely, with the rescue of the Palladium, Athena could turn her hand to its destruction. She imbued a Greek warrior Epeus with the idea and the skill to construct the Trojan horse. A much vaunted object, there is very little spoken about its form in the epics. Virgil, the Augustan poet, gives us the best description of this in Book 2 of the Aeneid. He tells us, "With the divine skill of Athena, the Greeks built a horse the size of a mountain, cutting pine trees to weave into it for ribs." Odysseus formulated the plan of hiding the Aristos, or the best, of the Achaeans inside the giant horse. Aside from the complicated man and Menelaus, Homer gives no indication which heroes made up this insurgent force. For the best picture, Quintus of Smyrna puts the total number of Achaeans within at 30, with Odysseus, Menelaus, Diomedes, Philoctetes, Neoptolemus, Meriones, among others. Whoever was there, the rest of the Greeks burnt down the camps they had lived in for a decade and sailed to a harbour in a sheltered bay of the nearby island of Tenedos, a place clearly visible from the mainland. In the morning, the lookouts on Troy's walls reported to their commanders, who in turn informed the king that the city was no longer under siege. As the men of Troy moved out to investigate, they are stunned to see the Greeks had abandoned the walls of Troy, their camps, and sailed off almost without a trace. I say almost due to the fact a large timber horse stood in the remains of the enemy's camp. The Trojans are perplexed at this point, and quickly fall into three groups as to the object's fate. The first wants to push it off a cliff into the sea. The second want to burn it where it stands, but the third and most vocal group claim it is holy and should be brought within the city. A Trojan seer comes screaming down from the holy city, cursing the Greeks as treacherous and the men of Troy as fools for trusting them. Virgil has this prophet utter the lines, "Do not trust the horse, Trojans. Whatever it is, I am afraid of Greeks, even when they bear gifts." This has been paraphrased by the modern proverb, "Beware of Greeks bearing gifts." A captured Greek and supposed deserter named Sinon spoke lies into the ears of the party for keeping the horse, and so the Trojans resolved to bring it to the city. This captive went further and told the citizens that the Achaeans made the tribute too large for the city's gates to prevent them from claiming it and the honour that went with. Blinded further by this deceit, the men of Troy tore down their walls to accommodate the offering. Helen was possibly once more upon the Scaean gate, watching events unfold in the plain before her. I think she took one look at the horse's cavernous womb and imagined it pregnant with the city's doom. In this instance, she had a modicum of control over what unfolded in the plain before her. The option of turning to King Priam and foiling the plot was hers alone amongst the city's inhabitants. However, she had given Odysseus her word and was a woman of scruples. Also, this oversized equine offering seemed to be the ticket out of her current predicament in which she found herself. From there, Helen turned her back, both literally and allegorically, on the people of Poseidon. retiring to her quarters to await fate. That night the citizenry gave themselves over to licentious debauchery, and justifiably so. In their minds they had not only withstood the greatest heroes of the age and a protracted, decade-long siege, they had carried off the enemy's tribute to venerate their own gods. All of that pent-up stress and fear was unleashed in a torrent of unwatered wine and celebration long into the night. I'm not sure what creatures were left fit for sacrifice, but any found would have been offered up in tribute to the gods and their beneficence. The poor fools, the last of the Olympians, had now abandoned them, and if any listened closely, their death knell could be heard ringing upon the slopes of nearby Mount Ida. Not all of the Trojans shared the optimism of those making merriment round the carven flanks of the horse. Two in particular weren't prepared to take the situation at face value. The first is the eponymous character from Virgil's epic, Prince Aeneas. In the epitome of Proclus, he at this time leaves the city and heads to Mount Ida, thus providing the premise for the Aeneid, where he survives the fall of Troy and becomes the antecedent of the Romans. The second, remaining unconvinced, is Helen's new husband, Deiphobus. Now I have to preface what I'm about to say as pure conjecture. It involves a rather inexplicable event in Book 4 of the Odyssey involving Helen and Menelaus. An event that has always made me question Helen's motives. I'd like to try as best I can to explain them. It takes place almost 10 years after the war, in Sparta. The couple are talking with the son of Odysseus, Telemachos, and regaling him with tales of his father during the Great War. The Spartan king tells a story from his time in the belly of the horse on the night Troy fell. In it, Helen is walking around the construction with Deiphobus. She begins to imitate the voices of the Achaeans' wives in an attempt, it seems, to lure them out. This almost comes to pass, but Telemachos is told that if it weren't for his father, the Greeks would have spilled out so filled with longing were they for their loved ones. As Menelaus reveals this apparent perfidy on his wife's behalf, he seems to bear her no malice, and even mentions that one of the Trojan gods put her up to the act. It's a confounding scene, and one I have struggled to reconcile. Menelaus's apparent apathy only compounds my confusion, but I believe the key to understanding the event lies in the fact of Helen's resolve and the literal translation of Deiphobus's name. As we've seen, Helen had by this stage made her mind up about returning home. And if she wanted to ruin the Achaeans' plans, many opportunities had presented themselves. None were taken. Her new husband's name in English means "he of wretched fear." On account of that wretched fear, I believe that Deiphobus left the party early and returned home filled with dread that the horse in some way was a portent of destruction. With more than a little wine under his belt, he confided in his Spartan wife the fear that filled him from the horse's presence. Telling her that he would go to his father, King Priam, and convince him at once to burn the wooden beast to the ground with or without his father's blessings. Ever astute, Helen would have recognized the possibility that a husband would be believed. The king's mind wasn't as strong as it once was, watching so many brave sons collapse dead before his eyes. He might have been inclined to do whatever was possible to keep those still living, happy, and safe. I can imagine Helen encircling her frantic husband in her shawl-covered arms, stroking his hair, and telling him that there was a better way to discern the threat posed by the horse. She knew many of the Greek captains' wives personally, and could impersonate their voices with ease. "Let us go before the timber monstrosity," she said, "and through guile coax out any within before we trouble your father further and interrupt his merriment. We know he has had scant to celebrate in many years." Drunk and besotted by the woman before him, Deiphobus acquiesced to her plans. Knowing full well that any plan of such cunning would involve the complicated man, she was sure that her deceit in imitation of the hero's wives would fail due to his presence. As always, she was right. Now, I've read a lot of debate regarding this scene laid out by Homer, but none of it has sufficiently described Helen's motives here, not for my satisfaction at any rate. If she truly was having second thoughts about committing the city to destruction, it would have been the simplest thing to go before King Priam and say something like the following. "Dear father, I confess that 2 nights previous I met with Odysseus in the guise of a beggar within the walls of Troy. I cleaned and clothed him, and he told me of his plan to take the city by trickery, where force had failed. This horse is surely the work of the man of twists and turns and can't be trusted. Burn it to the ground immediately if you wish to preserve your city." With such an utterance, she not only would have saved the city, but destroyed the flower of the enemy's leadership. Or Helen could have just let her Trojan husband go to his father and convince him or so many other possibilities. But we know that Troy, in the epics, always falls, and I think Helen in these final hours always intended for it to. This is precisely what transpired next, as a placated Deiphobus was returned home and the citizenry collapsed in sleep after so much wine and celebration. There were 31 persons within the holy walls who weren't sleeping off their indulgence. One of them was a deserter who through perfidy had convinced the Trojans of the horse's innocuous nature. Sinon scaled to the top of the Scaean gate and lit a signal fire which was seen by the Greek fleet anchoring at the island of Tenedos. The Achaean ships sailed directly to the mainland and disgorged an army hungry for slaughter upon the plain that had seen so much. The last facet of the city's doom fell into place as an opening appeared in the cavernous flank of the horse and a rope was lowered. Slithering to the ground came the 30 heroes of Greece ready to visit extirpation upon those who had defied them for so many years. The bloodshed that night was legendary, and I'll let Virgil tell us through Aeneas's eyes, quoting from Book 2 of the Aeneid. Who could unfold the horrors of that night? Who could speak of such slaughter? Who could weep tears to match that suffering? It was the fall of an ancient city that had long ruled an empire. The bodies of the dead lay through all its streets and houses and the sacred shrines of its gods. Bitter grief was everywhere, and everywhere there was fear and death in many forms. Putting to the torch the entire city, killing the men and the children, the Achaeans carried off the women and treasure to take back to Greece. Fearing that he would grow and revenge his father, the son of Hector, Astyanax, is cast from the city walls to his death by Odysseus. Hector's wife Andromache is taken as a slave by the son of the slayer of her dear husband back to Greece. The wife of Priam is taken in the same way by Odysseus, and poor Cassandra is torn from the altar of Athena by the other Ajax and given to Agamemnon as a concubine. Neoptolemus is relentless in his slaughter and comes across King Priam and another of his sons, Polites. The two Trojans are cornered by the son of Achilles at the altar of Zeus. Neoptolemus kills Polites before Priam's very eyes. A grief-stricken king reminds the murderer that Achilles was a better man and had forwarded Priam honour in the past. The son of Achilles repays the old man's words by dragging him to the altar and skewering him upon it. An act of impropriety fitting of the frustration and bloodlust felt by the Greeks at finally achieving their aims. What of Helen during all this destruction and mayhem? Did she go running towards her countrymen at the first sign of the city's capture? Her welcomed reunion was hardly a foregone conclusion, and worse still, which of the Trojans wouldn't have attempted to avenge themselves on her person given the chance? Her new husband had already been murdered by Menelaus, and there is even a story that she had hidden Deiphobus' sword beforehand. But Helen, we are told by Virgil once more, had fled to seek shelter in the temple of Hestia, the goddess of hearth, home, and family. A fitting retreat, and I'll quote here once more from Book 2 of the Aeneid, as Virgil paints her predicament in his customary eloquence. Aeneas says, "Now that I was alone, I caught sight of Helen keeping watch on the doors of the temple of Hestia, where she was staying, quietly hidden. The fires gave a bright light, and I was gazing all around me wherever I went. This Helen, this fury sent to be the scourge both of Troy and her native Greece, was afraid of the Trojans, who hated her for the overthrow of their city. She was afraid the Greeks would punish her and afraid of the wrath of the husband she had deserted. So hated by all, she had gone into hiding and was sitting there at the altar." This is the last glimpse of the Spartan queen before her rightful king came upon her and beheld her for the first time in over a decade. In the Lysistrata, a comedy by Aristophanes, we are told that Menelaus dragged her from the altar, intent on killing her. Though in the struggle her robe is torn and she is exposed, and her beauty in all its power causes the Spartan king to lose his resolve. Denied redress first by Paris's cowardice, and finally by Helen's legendary allure, he takes her back. I don't give this any credit. Aristophanes was the father of old comedy, and while the guffaws of Athenians at the theatre of Dionysius was his main aim, I believe he sold Helen short here. My feeling is that as soon as the two long-lost lovers laid eyes on one another, an understanding, acceptance, and forgiveness was reached, and as we'll soon see, there is no malice between the pair when they once again rule as king and queen of Sparta. I like to think that as they embraced, the fire, smoke, screams, and pain faded, and their thoughts turned to Hermione, waiting in Laconia, and of being the family they once were. so very long ago. The next day, the Achaean leaders and their men assembled at the waterfront for a division of spoils and captives. The smoking ruin of once mighty Troy provided a backdrop for what would be the penultimate event of the war. In the Euripidean tragedy, the Trojan Women, we see the level of enmity those women had for Helen. She who for so long resided under the aegis of Paris, Hector, Priam, and lastly, Deiphobus. Quoting from a middle episode, Euripides has Hecuba say the following: "I bless you, Menelaus, I bless you. If you will slay her, only beware to see her visage, lest she snare you and you fall. She ensnares strong men's eyes, she ensnares tall cities, and the fire from within her eats up houses. Such magic has she, as a cup of death." The mother of Hector makes it plain here that she would even give one of her greatest enemies a blessing if he would but rid the earth of Helen. Alas for Hecuba, that would not come to pass, and Euripides, writing nearly a millennia after the legendary date of the Trojan War, knew that too. Through all the trials and tribulations their fates had served up, it would seem merely a trivial journey back across the Aegean Sea to Sparta. Life wasn't about to get easy for Helen and Menelaus, though, as the gods had in store one final test for them first. Let's look on the bright side. It did give them a little bit of time to get to know one another again after so many years apart. They sailed across the sea with little event until they docked in the safe harbour of Sunium, a place in the region of Athens and barely 3 days sailing from home. Here, Apollo struck down the fleet's pilot with one of his shafts, a euphemism for the plague. After observing the necessary funeral rites and getting back underway, Zeus beset the fleet with a devastating storm. Blown off course by some 1,500 kilometres, only 5 ships limped into dock in the land of the Egyptians. They were becalmed in this fabled land for another 7 years, where among other things they were certainly reacquainted. In Book 4 of the Odyssey, we see Helen with many gifts from her time in Egypt. It seems the process of Xenia was observed in this faraway land as well. Although uneventful, the 7 years dragged on and prolonged their much-awaited Knossos to Sparta. Eventually, Menelaus tricked a god of the sea named Proteus to show him the way home. Getting more than he bargained for, Menelaus was shown his brother's murder by Clytemnestra and Aegisthus too. This broke the Spartan king's heart, but nonetheless allowed the couple to sail away and this time make it back home. So after their own odyssey, Helen and Menelaus return on the same day that Agamemnon's son Orestes avenged his father by killing both the usurper Aegisthus and his mother Clytemnestra. Being away from my son, little Leonidas, for even a few days makes seeing him again a very emotional event. As the saying goes, absence makes the heart grow fonder. I can barely imagine what the reunion between Helen and daughter looked like. Hermione was a child when her mother was abducted and her father left to win her back. Some 17 years bridged that moment to the homecoming, and it was no doubt a complex reconsolidation of familial relationships. Heavily laden with a plethora of vying emotions, it could easily have been the stuff of epic tale worthy of attention by Homer. He, however, focused his next great work on the return of Odysseus to his own family, and leaves us to fill in the sentiments of Helen, Menelaus, and Hermione together at last. Did Hermione blame her mother for the practically orphaned upbringing thrust upon her? How did she feel seeing her with the eyes of an adult when the last time she gazed upon Helen's radiant face was through the eyes of a child? Homer is silent on this, and it's a telling silence in my thoughts. As with other events, the father of epic is great at leaving his listeners with plenty of mental gymnastics to do on their own. I would say that in the archaic and classical periods, other regions outside of her home branded Helen in a variety of fashions. She was the whore of Troy to the Athenian playwrights, and elsewhere, anything from homewrecker to spoilt princess. In her home of Sparta, Helen was always worshipped as the epitome of Spartan womanhood, strong, resolute, intelligent, and liberated. I see no reason why this impression could not have come down from the Bronze Age, and no reason why Hermione didn't think of her mother in the same light. When next we meet King and Queen, 3 years have passed and they are visited by the son of Odysseus. Telemachus calls upon Helen and Menelaus in search of news of his father. The royal household is busy preparing for the wedding of Hermione to Neoptolemus, the son of Achilles. Despite its traditions being spat on by Paris, Xenia is still practiced by Helen and Menelaus, and they forward Telemachus every hospitality. Although invited to stay on in Sparta, Telemachus presses the king and queen for any information they have on Odysseus, as he needs to return to Ithaca as quickly as possible. lest his mother is forced to marry one of her many suitors. It's in this scene that Helen relates the story of her meeting Odysseus within the city of Troy with him dressed as a beggar. Menelaus follows by sharing the story of Helen imitating the voices of the Achaean wives. This interaction brings up many painful memories for its participants, and they give over to sorrow. Interestingly, it is Helen who provides the panacea for their pain by mixing a drug, most probably opium, into wine for everyone. This drug was a gift to her from Polydamna, wife of Thon, a woman in Egypt. In Homer's words, in Book 4 of the Odyssey, "Whoever drinks wine thus drugged cannot shed a single tear all the rest of the day, not even though his mother and father both drop dead, or he sees a brother or a son hewn in pieces before his very eyes." In the words of that great scholar, Seinfeld's Mr. Peterman, it sounds like they took a ride on the white horse. As all parties grow weary, Helen makes sleeping arrangements for Telemachus and retires to bed with Menelaus. This scene is significant for several reasons. Firstly, it shows the Spartan couple back together in harmony after all that has occurred. Secondly, it clearly describes the power Mycenaean women had in affairs of state. Helen is not only a participant, she is the driver of this scene, beginning the storytelling and providing the means through which the tragedy of the stories can be somewhat ameliorated. When the child of morning, rosy-fingered Dawn, appeared, Menelaus recounts to Telemachus the story told to him by the Egyptian god Proteus regarding Odysseus. The discussion breaks off here in Book 4 of the Odyssey, and Homer only comes back to it much later in Book 15, with Telemachus now ready to leave Sparta to return to Ithaca. As is common with Xenia, he is receiving suitable gifts from Menelaus and Helen. Zeus's daughter gives to him, as a present for a future bride-to-be, a robe woven by her own hand and beautifully enriched with embroidery. In my humble opinion, this wasn't just any robe. Homer's genius is sometimes obvious, sometimes subtle, but it's always sublime in its realization. I believe the father of epic has woven some innuendo into this scene of robe offering by Helen to Telemachus. If you cast your mind back to the last episode when we first met Helen behind the walls of Troy, she was, and I quote from Book 3 of the Iliad, in front of the loom, making a large purple robe in which she had woven many fierce combats that the Trojans and Argives both had endured on the field of battle. In my mind, it is a fitting gift to the departing son of Odysseus, a keepsake and memento of the deeds his father had performed. Moreover, symbolically it would be a handing over of legend to the next generation of heroes and for Helen, leaving behind memories of Troy once and for all. Though in the Odyssey it is just one of the many dresses Helen has within her storage chest, all of them made by her own hand. That this robe was obviously a favourite, as Homer tells us that it was from the very bottom of the chest. There really isn't any evidence to support the two robes being the same, just a whimsical fantasy on my part. I could even be going a little mad from poring over the evidence so much, but I wouldn't put such intricacy past Homer. Finally, for epic Helen, as Telemachus is ready to depart after he and his travelling companion finish loading up the Xenia-required gifts of Sparta, a portent occurs. An eagle with a white goose in its talons appears overhead. With the farmers shouting and running after it, the eagle banks across the royal grouping and flew away on their right-hand side. The son of Nestor, Pisistratus, turns to Menelaus to gauge his thoughts on what this could mean. The Spartan king ponders for a moment, but it's his queen who speaks first. As these will be Helen's last words in the epics, I'll quote them in full from Book 15 of the Odyssey. "I will read this matter, as heaven has put it in my heart, and as I doubt not that it will come to pass. The eagle came from the mountain, where it was bred, and has its nest, and in a like manner, Odysseus, after travelling so far and suffering so much, will return to take his revenge, if indeed he is not back already, and hatching mischief for the suitors." Now either she's already read the Odyssey, or her Zeus-given semi-divinity came with no small amount of auspicious interpretation. Whichever, what she tells Telemachus warms his heart and all comes to pass as Helen described. And that's it. We hear no more from Helen in the epics as Telemachus and Pisistratus whip the horses into motion. The personification of premise for the Trojan War simply fades to black. In this last scene it is clear how Homer wanted us to see Helen. No trace of culpability is hers to bear. She is a valued member of the community, and welcome to offer powerful men her advice and wisdom without reproach. These final two scenes also show us a different Helen, one who, while still beautiful, is no longer the focus of unbridled amorous affection. A mature woman, comfortable with husband, home, and hearth. Homer has saved one final trick for Helen, though, and it's one that's been deeply appreciated by authors and playwrights since the epic works were written down for posterity's study. Unlike the 108 suitors of Penelope, Achilles, Hector, and so many others, we learn nothing of Helen's eventual death. He stayed silent on the final chapter of The Every Woman's Life, therefore providing fertile ground for imagination. Before I wrap up, I'll recount one very brutal telling of her possible fate which happens in the Euripidean tragedy called Orestes. This work tells an epilogue to the saga of Agamemnon's return from Troy and subsequent murder. After 7 years, the Greek king's son, Orestes, returns and slays his mother and her lover in revenge for his father's demise. As the play gets into full swing, Electra, the eponymous character's sister, convinces Orestes that killing Helen will undo the harm done by his matricide. Helen is the real cause of all the grief the House of Atreus has endured. If she never ran off with Paris, Agamemnon would never have left. Iphigenia would avoid sacrifice, and Clytemnestra would remain the faithful wife and queen of Mycenae. In the climax of this drama, Hermione bursts into view only to be greeted by her mother in throes of death, with Orestes standing over her stained in blood. The daughter of Helen is taken prisoner by Orestes, and once restrained, he turns back to finish the job. Helen, however, has mysteriously disappeared. Word reaches Menelaus, and he heads off to confront the murdering antagonist for the foul deeds committed. In a classic deus ex machina, Apollo appears and says, "Helen's beauty was merely an instrument of Zeus for setting Greek and Trojans face to face in war, thus multiplying the deaths to purge the bloated earth of its superfluous welter of humanity." Inferring that Helen has been taken to reside with the gods on Mount Olympus and will live in immortality. The will of Zeus has come to its end. Personally, I like to think of Helen growing old, as she is in Ovid's Metamorphosis, living out the rest of her days in Sparta with her rightful husband, being the loving grandmother of Hermione's children, and passing peacefully next to Menelaus on a warm spring night. There is in my mind none more deserving of peace than the face that launched 1,000 ships. I can't believe it's over. This deep dive into the life of Helen has given me a newfound respect for the subject. Not merely a plot device, she was the main driver of everything and the single person without which there would be no epic saga. There is so much depth to her story that I could have written a 5 or even 6-part series on her life. I'll take my lead from Mad Max and Lethal Weapon and leave it as a trilogy. So where to next? Well, next we're going to take a look into some of the Greek myths that I've touched on in the last few episodes by fleshing out the lives of Helen's brothers, the twins, Castor and Polydeuces. They were a part of the Calydonian boar hunt and were also shipmates on the Argo, joining Jason in his quest for the Golden Fleece. Let's not forget rescuing Helen from the clutches of that dirty scoundrel Theseus. For those of you living in the Northern Hemisphere, you get to see the pair's final resting place in the stars as the constellation Gemini. Their story is little known today, but they were legends of the classical Mediterranean world, and I can't wait to get into it. The invitation is out. Join me on the 3rd of May for the next installment of Spartan History Podcast with Episode 4, Immortal Twins. Until then, dear listeners, take good care and speak soon. Now, I normally finish these off with what is arguably a witty rejoinder. I won't this time, though I will mention that I really wanted to call the next episode The Gruesome Twosome, so maybe that counts. At any rate, a quick message for you. I've created a free, members-only section of my website where I'll be showcasing some additional content that doesn't quite meet the purview of this show's mission statement. It does, however, satisfy my propensity for rumination and digression. Somewhere I can put little tidbits I find interesting but aren't entirely relevant to the current episode. This is on the back of some advice I've received from a friend whose opinion I respect. It should help me avoid clutter and stay on task. This month's topic will be the Palladium of Athena, mentioned in this episode. Check the show's notes for further information. Finally, please check out my website, spartanhistorypodcast.com, where I have extra information, photos, and maps of the areas discussed. You can find me on Twitter at Spartan_history and on Facebook too at Spartan History Podcast. If you like this episode and are keen to hear more, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your pods from, and leave a review. Enjoy the outro. See you next time.